And now, the starting lineup for your...
Gangsters, what's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
MVP.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.
What the hell is going on out here?
Hello and welcome to Flicking and Screaming. I am Jed Sprague here with my co-hosts, Evan Fagundes.
Hey.
And a man who is nothing if he is not a reckless Visigoth. It is JT Chipman.
What's going on?
And this week we are discussing the new Alexander Payne film, The Holdovers. But before we get into that, gentlemen, I would love to know, how are you doing? Evan, talk to me about your mental state.
About my mental state. Not that different from the characters in The Holdovers. You know, no. Extremely different.
Pre or post-helicopter.
Exactly. Post-helicopter on their way to Aspen or whatever. That is what I have going on. I'm feeling good. And I have to say that this movie helped a lot. I loved seeing this movie with it being kind of cold out. I'm not saying like this movie improved my mental well-being necessarily, but this seemed like the perfect time of year to see a movie like this. I love when movies like this come out when it is kind of cold and wet out, and it just felt like it slotted into the right spot. So I think it is contributing to me feeling the season a little bit. Chip, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I got nothing really to report on my end. Just happy to have seen a lovely little Christmas time film to talk about it with my friends as the holidays approach. What more could I need? What more could I need? Jed, what's going on with you?
You know, it's been a long day. My poor wife has a double ear infection. My children are feral. God bless them. They are feral toddlers. And I'm sitting here with a alarmingly full glass of wine, getting ready to talk about a movie that I really, really enjoyed. So I think I'm good. You know, it's like sometimes you can't appreciate the good times unless you go through some frustration, some heartache. I think that's what this movie, is espousing. And I also think that's what I'm doing here tonight. So pause for sip.
I'll do some filibustering while you sip. I can confirm that the glass is very full, and it's less full now.
But what I want to ask you guys is Alexander Payne, what's your relationship to him? Because I think at the beginning of this year, when we're kind of listing off what has been almost an epic year for legendary filmmakers releasing new projects, I think a lot of really famous directors releasing new films. That was not on top of my list, Alexander Payne, but I kind of go back and I look through his filmography and I'm like, wait, hold on. I just like really like all of his movies. Like a lot of his movies have like a significant place in my heart, but I never really associate him as like an auteur, like, or like one of my guys, like I would with Wes Anderson or, like we do with PTA. And so I want to know what your relationship is to him, because for me, I'm like struggling with it a bit.
I'll go first and make it more complicated. This is my first Alexander Payne movie. I actually have not seen any of his other movies. They're just, and looking through his filmography, there's a lot of really solid from my understanding, really solid flicks there. All like middle of the line dramedies a little bit, and all like movies that generally get a couple of award noms, a little bit of buzz, but just all completely missed me. I think sometimes when a movie is so perfectly middle of the road, I tend to swerve out of the way towards something more extreme on one end or the other. And in my journey, I've just missed him up until this point. So it is now a goal of mine to catch up on the rest, especially Sideways. That's one that I think is so core to this pod and to you, Jed, and I think to Evan as well, that really needs to get checked off pretty soon.
Canonical.
Well, I know about the Merlot bit from Sideways. That's from Sideways, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was making sure. There's that other wine movie that Jed really likes that's like...
Bottle Shock.
Yeah, that's the one. But that one's
with like Chris Pine and Rickman.
Yeah, great poster, Bottle Shock.
Yeah, not as good of a film as Sideways, but we can get into that later. Evan, future versus relationship.
I love where you guys are coming from. Chip, what I would say about Alexander Payne, and it's something looking back on his filmography, because I don't necessarily think of all of these as Alexander Payne movies unless I'm seeing that that's the case. But all of them are, he's like an auteur of adult life. Like, I feel like I almost connect these movies with, like, how do I put it? Not scandalous, but I remember watching when I was young being like, ooh, this feels very adult. Like, I feel like I'm getting kind of let in the room a little bit if I'm, like, watching this with my parents, or feeling like I'm understanding it, but, you know, maybe not getting all of the dynamics. And I think now looking back at him, he kind of does take that middle of the road type movie. I know what you mean when you say that, Chip, and just like elevates it, just makes it a you know, 4 or 5 star movie versus like the 2.5, 3 that it very much could be and are still good. And actually, like, a lot of holiday movies, I feel like, are like that way, where it's like perfectly enjoyable. But if you really have somebody who like understands how to get two people to connect in a movie, and really understands family dynamics, it can be like upped a little bit. So that's sort of the relationship that I have looking back. For me, it's Election in Nebraska are the two that I have just deep ties to, like really enjoying with my family growing up.
Yeah, I think you guys are both onto something. For me, I think when I think of Alexander Payne movies, and this is, again, this is much more like in retrospect than coming into this movie necessarily with any preconceived notion, but I have been revisiting some of his films in preparation for this, so I'm really excited to talk about what other ones we all love. But I think that you could argue that there's not a director that has just a more plain and perfect understanding of the human condition, like the American, like, human condition. Like, there, I know he's made films that are, you know, set outside, but I just think of him as like a really like American director with a lot of American sensibilities, and I don't know, he's really interested in familial dynamics, of course, but I think more than that, he's just really like really interested in like relationships, and not like limited to familial relationships, and not limited to romantic relationships, right? Like, what are the deep ties that we can have with people outside of the bond of romance, outside of the bond of family? And like, I think that really stood out for me in this one. I think a lot of it is of this movie is a bit more about the found family, right? And the people that, you know, you will, I hate saying this, but the people you'll ride for and the people you will, you know, make sacrifices for, by choice rather than by having to. And yeah, I don't know. It's just really interesting watching this. I don't know. It's maybe weird to say this, but it's like, as an adult, this is my first Alexander Payne movie that I feel like I've watched as like a real adult, and it hits a little bit differently on first watch. You know, I was in college when I saw Sideways for the first time, you know, and I think I saw The Descendants even before that. And so there's been a lot of like different kind of baggage that I've brought, and I almost wonder how the holdovers would have hit me if I watched it while I was in college or watched it while I was in high school. But yeah, I don't know, just different.
Interesting you say that, because I think that holdovers might hit the hardest as an adult. I wonder if, you know, a movie that explores, you know, high school, boarding school, something like it, you immediately think of The Breakfast Club when you start watching this movie, right? That movie, I think, is designed to hit teenagers as teenagers. It's when you're supposed to watch it. That's when you're going to feel it the hardest. I wonder if this one would, if as a teenager, you may not fully get it. I do wonder if this is one that as an adult, you really need to be an adult, because I think it finds a lot more coming from the Giamatti character. And I think that the Angus character is like not really like he's kind of a grown up in a lot of ways. He's got young person problems, right? But he's been held back before, right? He clearly is above the rest of the kids around him, the rest of the students around him. And to me, I don't know, I really felt the adult drama of it all a little bit more than I think the teenage drama of it all. I don't know if you guys agree.
Yeah, I would say that I agree. And I think it's hard to argue against the fact that like the Giamatti character is kind of the lens through which we're looking through everything. But yeah, I don't know. It is interesting. I think it would hit. I think it could still hit young people. I think it's hard to like say that it wouldn't, just because, especially if you're a young person going through, any kind of parental issues or familial. I think that Angus character would resonate, like a lot of the anger and a lot of like that pent up, like the emotion that he's dealing with. I don't know.
I mean, it's interesting. It's so hard to know, you know, right? Like, I can't believe we're already at the age where we're just like, I wonder what the teenagers think about this. You know, can they relate to this? Like, if I was 17, I'd
that's exactly
be
what I'm thinking.
This, but that's okay. This is a movie about what happens to you in your teenage years affecting you for the rest of your life in a way, or big chunks of this movie. And, you know, that like nature versus nurture, and, you know, do your experiences really dictate who you're going to be in 40 years? You know, is it like almost locked in a way? And that's interesting from a younger person's perspective too, especially because the thing about this movie is like everyone in it is pretty smart, even if they're stubborn or, disagreeable. I feel like they kind of have an understanding. So it is interesting at the end of this movie, like people seem to, at least people in the movie seem to have really like understood the message, even if it doesn't really help them very much. I don't know if that makes it more accessible to somebody watching the movie. I guess I should have finished that thought. Like, everyone in the movie seems to really understand it. Like, the kid seems to be interested in it. You know, if you were younger, could you see yourself like relating a little bit to like the idea that maybe an adult is trying to help you not make the same mistakes that they did?
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I think is like a fascinating decision, because there's a lot of like choices that are made in this movie of like, but like of the characters and obviously like the interactions. And I think a lot of it like with the setting, but one thing that really stood out to me was the decision to like have it all happen over the holidays. Because I think there's like a world where this same kind of movie with like the same kind of, I guess, plot, for lack of a better word, could happen in like a summer school setting, right? Of, hey, you know, these kids have to get held back for summer school for a couple weeks. Something happens where a couple of the kids get jailbroken and it's a one-on-one situation with a teacher. But I think like the really like distinct choice of the holidays and like kind of, I think like a lot of the movie can be summed up, like you said, in a couple of scenes and a couple of moments, like where things get revealed. But for me, like one of the most core moments of the film is when, I think it's Christmas Day dinner, and they're all three, Mary and Angus, and I can't remember Giamatti's character's name, of course, but they are.
I think it's actually Paul. I think his first name in the movie is Paul. It is.
Oh yeah, yeah, Paul Hunnam. Mr. Hunnam.
Mr. Hunnam. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Hunnam. When they're having dinner, and Angus, the Dominic Sessa character, basically says, "I think this is the first like real Christmas dinner I've ever had," you know, and kind of like that understanding of like finding the meaning in like small moments. And I don't know, it really affected me in a lot of ways. And I think the other thing that's really underrated, and I guess kind of circling back around Alexander Payne, like we've talked a lot about his drama. We talked a lot about, you know, his like adult themes and all these different things about him. But something that Chip kind of clued on, all these movies are fucking funny. Like I laughed out loud 5 or 6 times, you know, like, these movies are really funny and kind of funny in that painfully real way. I kind of laugh you do when you yelp, when you're like, ah, you know, that one, I do that a lot. You know?
Yeah. I mean, Election is like one of my all time comedies. Like, I think that's one of the funniest movies ever.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, and I think like some of them are much more like straightforward, like, hey, trying to be a comedy. This one, I feel like the comedy is a little, not hidden, but it is secondary to the story it's trying to tell, but it's still friggin' hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
It's sprinkled in there with Giamatti's expansive vocabulary. I mean, and mm-hmm. Jed, you hit on him already, but when he's calling his students Visigoths or Philistines or whatever, I mean, it is uproariously funny, right? And it's also very self-serious from Giamatti. He's like, no, these are actual cretins that I am having to deal with every day, and you don't understand how painful that is for me, an enlightened historian, to deal with these nincompoops.
Yeah, and it's funny before you even realize like why he harbors so much angst and hatred towards these privileged children, right? because all they are is a representation of the classmate that basically ruined his life in his mind. But yeah, I don't know. I think we're kind of dancing around it. You guys want to talk about moments, or you want to talk about performances?
So really, let's start with moments, because I feel like performances are going to come in those moments.
I agree,
because they're tied in a movie like this so much more than lots of others. Can I just say, like, what did you guys think? And obviously we're in the age of these older filmmakers looking back on their lives. Like, this movie opens with a couple of longer tracking shots and during the credits, right? And one of the last shot of the credits ends with directed by Alexander Payne, and it's right over an empty chair at a table, right? Like, I'm just curious, like, what you guys generally think of that. We haven't talked about that much, but like, he is basically placing himself in a chair in this movie, right? And like, that's like a more forward, I think, admission to, like, you know, putting yourself in your work than lots of directors do. Or am I reading into it too much? I'm just curious to know what your guys' thoughts were.
I don't know if you're reading into it too much. I think the one thing we can't gloss over when talking about the entire opening sequence is the entire credit sequence is designed to make you think it is a movie out of the year 1970, right?
Yeah.
Like,
that's true.
All of the logos of all the studios are throwback, right? All of the, like, just the whole introduction is just something out of a different era. And when he drops that directed by Alexander Payne, you know, in that chair, I almost felt, Evan, it was less like him placing himself in the movie and more like him placing himself in the moment. If that is just, and maybe that was based on like the pretext of everything that I watched before, but I thought that's kind of what it was. It was like, we're here.
Yeah.
You know,
like, so I was there.
Then this is about me. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's ostensibly the chair that Giamatti's character is going to sit in. So I think there certainly is a little bit of like, hey, you can, this equals me. This chair equals me. But it's kind of just hard as hell. Like that image with directed by Alexander Payne on an empty chair is like one of the sicker directed by credits that I've seen in a movie in a while, you know. Agreed. And sometimes the placement matters in the sequencing. So sometimes it's at the very beginning and it's like a film by David Fincher and you're like, oh my fucking God. But this one, it's at the end and it's built into like the frame, into the composition. You don't always see that. That's just like a cool little trick.
Yeah, it's where a different director would drop the title card, right, of the film, right? You could very easily see that same shot being like the holdovers just on the blank chair, but he's like directed by Alexander Payne, you know.
And you talk about making this movie look like it's from the 70s. This movie was shot on a digital camera. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how a movie can be shot on a digital camera and have this film grain filter texture applied over it and not look stupid.
I'm pretty sure, and this is like, a lot of people have done this, and this is not like new technology, but I'm pretty sure he like shoots digital and then feeds the edited cut like through film processing. So it's still like on film. Like it's still been like rendered on film at a point.
That's fascinating. That seems like it would take
but
so much
I see work. What you mean, Chip. Like, hearing that without being technical at all, it makes it sound like it would have to be kind of fucked up a little bit. You know, there has to be something to using the actual cameras themselves with film. But I see what you mean. Like, it's obviously just an amazing technical job.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is, like, don't discount how much of that old school look is, like, vintage lenses. And, like, a lot of people achieve, like, that softness from the camera by using older lenses than they do just by shooting on film, right? And I think it's just a testament to, like, we talk about film, we talk about digital all the time, and it's really just like the person using the medium, right? I think we never complain. Yeah. Like, we just talked about David Fincher. What, how many weeks? 3 weeks in a row? I don't know how many weeks in a row. I thought this was a David Fincher podcast. But we never complain about the way his projects work or look. And he's shot on digital a ton, right? Pioneer.
But he does it well.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's just all about how you do it, right?
Right.
You know, that clip was surfacing recently of Ruffalo and Downey Jr. talking about how he invented the delete button on the digital film camera so that he could delete takes on set. Anyway, we're not going to talk about Fincher anymore. We're talking about Alexander Payne.
Anyway. We could talk about Fincher more if you wanted to.
What do you think David Fincher thinks about this movie? Too sentimental for him? Too sincere?
Oh, I think he loves it.
I don't know. I think, like, this movie made Mank. Crafted. He's got a soft side.
And, like, this movie is so crafted. I mean, like, you guys are talking about, even just in the title sequence, like, Alexander Payne has an eye. Like, he is not just making, you know, a movie with great dialogue where he's just needing to put people in front of the camera and kind of let them cook. Like, this movie is very, very directed. There are a lot of, you know, camera turns, like some of the zooms and like even some of the, like, I don't know, there's some lens flaring in there. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot in there that David Fincher's chewing on.
Yeah. Let's talk about some more moments. We talked about, like, the directed by drop, but I'd also love to know. Okay. Yeah.
I love it. 2.5 minutes in.
What are some, like, other, like, what are some scenes that really stand out to you? I think for me, like, the first history class, you know, when you kind of get the, once we've gotten, like, the scene set, and it's so important, right? We've met Giamatti's character. We've met some of the other characters that are in this scene, kind of seeing them collide for the first time, him joyfully handing out, you know, D's and F pluses, which I've never seen that before. That made me laugh so hard. You know, on the ancient civilization's final exam while wistfully whistling Flight of the Valkyries was mm-hmm. just like chef's kiss stuff. And I think it was like a really good primer for everything that was to come. And I thought really interesting too of like the only person in that we see get a good grade is the Angus character, right? He gets a B+. Mm-hmm. But still, he's a, you know, he ends up being kind of the crux of Giamatti's frustration throughout the film.
Exactly. And he's so funny in that scene. It's just, it's ridiculous how funny he is. And also, I know I'm getting old because I'm like, ooh, he's kind of right about these students, isn't he? You know, like, I'm like, he's ripping them a new one and he's making some good points about how entitled these little pricks are. And he's obviously, like, too hard on them, but, you know, maybe we need a little more of that. Maybe a little more red assing in our classrooms, you know? This is my political platform for the year.
Absolutely. And to take it a step further, like, I love that he actually follows through with it. You know, it's like not empty threats at all when he's threatening more reading and things like that. You do believe it. And obviously he, you know, you'd imagine he's going to come around to an extent. You know, he doesn't seem like a completely unfair person. But it is funny just how, like, what a fastball it throws at the very beginning. I'd say that one, and then leading right into, like, is it the first time sitting that we see them sit down for dinner? I feel like that was where the movie really took a turn.
Yeah, for sure. When the whole group of all is there.
When the whole group is there, and what's the kid's name? Brady. No, the actor's name is
Coons.
Brady, right?
Teddy Coons.
Teddy Coons, man.
Mr. Coons. Which is, by the way, like, that's some subtext right there.
Yes.
The biggest douchebag character is being named is Coons.
But, like, when he makes his comment about Mary, and you really are kind of like, oh, okay, so this is actually who we can really attach ourselves to in this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like the character's proving themselves a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, I also just really enjoyed, like, a lot of the time that it spends in those little moments with all the boys together, you know, when they're standing out by the Jason guy's truck, you know, taking a hit off some weed and, you know, talking about the only reason I'm staying here is because I wouldn't cut my hair and my dad wouldn't let me come home unless I cut my hair. And just kind of like, not all these circumstances are the same, right? Some of these guys, like, one poor kid is stuck because his family's all the way in Korea and he's crying himself to sleep every night. I think that was another good moment. You know, where we get to kind of see Angus's softer side for the first time, right? Because up until that point, he's kind of made out to be a dickhead. You know, we don't really see anything redeeming about him. And I think they do a really good job of showing flashes of redeeming qualities of these two kind of, I don't know, annoying characters. Is that like a safe thing to say? Like people that, like, if you met in real life would annoy you, right? They're
you're
like,
talking about Hunnam and Angus.
Hunnam and Angus, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because when Hunnam like yells at Koontz for disrespecting Mary, that's like, oh yeah, this guy will stand up for people who have been trotted on too much.
Yes.
Exactly. And
like he is fair. Like he you know, that doesn't make him a good person. He needs to do more than that. But it shows that, like, he is not somebody who will stand for injustice. Like, he can be disagreeable, but not, like, the devil or something, yeah. You know? Like,
hey, man, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
I think, like, I watched this with Rachel, and she actually really loved it. She like, we turned it off, and she's like, I really liked that movie. But I think the thing that she said, like, kind of sums it up the best, and obviously it's so on its face, but she's like, ah, the unlikely pair that ends up not being so unlikely, right? Like, the people, like, we've seen it a million times before, right? The sworn enemies that, you know, find their similarities. But I think the way that they mirror each other, the way that they come to understanding one another, like, over the course of the movie, and we can talk about, right, it really kicks off once everybody else gets, you know, taken away in a helicopter. But I don't know. I just really thought that their relationship, obviously being like the crux, and I know Mary is also a big part of that, but especially once we get to Boston, you realize, like, oh, the movie's really about their relationship. They are the crux of whether or not this movie works. And I really thought that Dominic Sessa and Paul Giamatti, like, their chemistry was off the charts. I want to watch like a young rookie cop, old chief, you know, buddy cop movie with them. Like, can't you see that too?
Absolutely. Sometimes just, I mean, they're two such incredible performances too. But sometimes just like pain and anger, right, can be enough for two people to bond. Like, they don't even have to go, you don't even have to really see the breakthrough happen that much in front of your eyes to understand why these two characters are ultimately able to, see eye to eye or eyes to eye, you know, however you'd like to define it.
It's this one.
It's this Evan. Oh my God. We're really jumping ahead, but what a moment. That was next level.
It really was. If I can talk about another favorite moment, I really liked the Christmas party with Miss Crane. Lydia Crane, I think, was the character's name that we meet via Christmas cookie and waitressing at the bar, which is such a funny detail, too, that I don't know if she's a teacher or she's on faculty, and she's got to pull some shifts at the local shit dive bar over Christmas break to make some extra money.
Headmaster's executive assistant, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. That was like a sneaky little good detail that I think tells you a lot about like that school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this party is so fun because you really do see each individual arc play out, because Mary can't stop drinking and weeps over her son, needs to be helped out, right? Even though the janitor is trying to hit on her the entire time. Love the janitor. Danny's the best.
Yeah.
Angus gets a little play in the basement. Gets a little action. All he's got to do is talk with Jackson Pollock a little bit, and he's hitting it off, and he's showing another side of himself, where he's talking about like the MoMA and all that, and doing the finger painting and letting himself turn over to the artistic side. But in particular, there's the moment where Giamatti's character is talking to Lydia, and he's like, he's feeling himself a little bit, right? He sprayed on the little Glade from the bathroom aerosol, and they're hitting it off. And then she gets up and kisses her man as he comes in, and it zooms on his face, and it's playing. It's the most wonderful time of the year. Like that hits as it's zooming on his face. And that's, again, a funny but very sad moment. Incredibly sad and painful. And Giamatti just wears it all over his face.
You got to watch Sideways, Chip, because like this and Sideways obviously are a great pair, because Giamatti kind of plays like a very similar kind of person as far as just like pained with the world around him, you know, a victim of the circumstance of being alive, you know, having to deal with everyone. And in those there are those same moments in Sideways where he allows himself for just a brief moment to like be human, to believe, and then is immediately crushed. And I think like that is what Paul Giamatti does better than anybody else. And I agree, that was like a spectacular moment. The party was awesome. I love that, you know, like, again, so classic teenage boy. Angus is like, listen, we care about Mary. Like, we want to make sure she gets home, but can we come back afterwards? Like, I need, like, yeah. He's like, I kissed a girl down in the basement. Like, I would like to see that through.
Because you see his anger a little bit too when he tells off Paul because he doesn't know about his dad and all that. So you get the wide spectrum of teenage emotion that can be one thing one moment and another thing the next. And it doesn't take much to flip him from one side to the other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that was like Paul's big turning point too, right? Like that's kind of what that moment basically sets the course for.
I think a little bit because that's Christmas Eve. And then she's like, Lydia's like, what are you doing for Christmas bar? And he's like, I don't know. And then he goes and buys the tree and gets the Christmas Day scene. That's another great moment.
Yeah.
So he goes to buy the tree. There's a side wipe transition. Did y'all catch that?
Yes.
Diana, sharp eye, saw that right away. That side transition, that wipe, gets the tree. It looks like the Charlie Brown Christmas tree because it's really pathetic and doesn't have ornaments and it's leaning over. And then he gets them both copies of Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, which I think is also like, I don't know if this is just extra mythology, but I believe that's the book that Robert De Niro's character was reading in prison in Heat. That's like the book that like changed his perspective on everything.
That's also super hot in the streets right now because like Marcus Aurelius Meditations is basically like it's like the founding of Stoicism. And like that is like a really, really, really hot social media thing of like the idea of Stoicism. There's many, many social media accounts dedicated to just like talking about Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, which made me crack up. And I wondered if that was like a
comedy. The idea of a TikTok about Stoicism is just laden with irony in and of itself. But yeah, so then that I think that is the tipping point, is I think what I guess I'm eventually getting at here. Because even when he's mad at Angus for running off in the theater, he still goes with him to see his dad. So that Christmas party really is the biggest catalyst in a line of in the journey that comes over the next 45 minutes.
Yeah, and right, that's the heart of the movie, I think, when they're in Boston. And like everything, like obviously everything leads up to that point.
And there's that freaking soundtrack that plays when there's that extended montage of Mary talking to her sister and like giving her a hug, crying, laughing. And then the boys going up the steps into the museum, checking out the pornography in the museum. And there's this just amazing guitar.
It's the candy cane. That was like one of the ultimate lines when it's just his head looking at two people fucking on a vase. On an ancient vase, and he goes, "It's the candy cane.
It's the candy cane."
Oh my god!
My loins used to run white hot.
That's where the movie really gets cooking. Like,
oh, that was like the best scene in the movie. I mean, just that little moment.
White hot.
Like, white hot.
They literally cut to black.
You wouldn't believe it.
That, and then it's like right back to back. They're in the hotel room, and he sees his depression medication, and like he walks, you know, like Seth's characters, Angus, all like embarrassed about it, and then you see Paul Giamatti take it out, like look at the exact same medicine and pop a couple himself.
How crazy is it this is Dominic Seth's first credited role,
bro? All right, are we ready to move into performances?
I don't get that.
Let's do we have any more moments
before we... I don't get that. It's just a really funny thing to say right there.
I don't
I don't get it either.
He was fucking unbelievable. He was so good. And he like ate up the center of the frame, by the way. Like the entire time he was on screen.
I know. I just like I'm almost like I've seen that guy. Like like don't believe it because he's like seems so natural in a movie.
He's like, what if Finn Wolfhard was good at acting?
Wow.
Don't even disgrace Sessa like that.
Well, it's the hair. I think there's some hair similarities. Is maybe what I'm getting at.
It's pretty crazy.
Of, like, Evan saying like he looks like someone you've seen before. I wonder if it's Finn Wolfhard, because I was thinking about that at least.
He's only 21.
I could see that.
Yeah, he's only 21. And he just kind of gets plucked out of nowhere. And I think like lays down just an incredible, incredible performance. I don't know another way to describe it. He goes toe to toe with Giamatti, who is just like, whether or not you like all the projects that he does, like when was the last time you saw Paul Giamatti put in like even a mediocre performance? Like, Billions, those first couple seasons of Billions are like incredibly watchable because Paul Giamatti is just like eating the scenery. Like he just understands how to take whatever is assigned to him and make it more. And you've got a guy that, like a kid that's 21 years old, that's just going toe to toe with him the whole movie.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, this is a very hard role. That, like, the Angus character is very difficult, I think, because he is a very complicated person where, you know, the idea pretty early on, you do feel bad for him because, and that's why the holiday setting is so effective, because it's just like the inherent thing. All the other kids, it's not only that they're gone, it's not only that it's that they're going somewhere to be with family, right? Ostensibly, like, be with family, whatever, like the American ideal holiday or whatever that like the advertisements would sell. And so you're automatically on his side. So like he has a built-in excuse for being a dickhead, but at the same time, he also has empathy. And I feel like that's like a really hard thing to pull off without just seeming like it's too much for somebody to handle. And then you add in the fact that he is in a Giamatti vehicle, which is like has to be pretty daunting considering Paul Giamatti more often maybe is only in like a third of a movie, but is like eating the entire time. Like the idea of going against that for an entire movie seems challenging.
So how about this? Sessa had never acted in anything other than school plays. So he was a senior at Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts, college in Massachusetts, in a production of Rumors. And basically, that's where they end up filming at Deerfield Academy is where they end up filming The Holdovers. And when they were on location scouting, they said, oh, casting directors were coming to like see if anybody, you know, that was in the drama program would be like suitable to like presumably just be like one of the extra boys in the film. And the next day he was at like one of their football games and he got a call after like they saw him in the production. So like he went from acting in school plays to being in Alexander Payne's next movie.
And I wonder if that's crazy.
There's an element of that where it's like I almost feel like being the very first thing.
Yeah. Like there's a rawness that he was able to tap into. Yeah,
it almost allows him to be fearless, right? He doesn't know. Yeah, he doesn't have like all this built up anxiety of doing a lot of small things and this being his big break. It's just like this is the first ever film I've done, and like how he can maybe I don't know. I mean, it's not to take anything away. Like the performance is still incredible, but it almost just feels like there's something so fresh. He reminds me of a young Adam Driver, like when you'd see Adam Driver pop up in those like Noah Baumbach roles. You know what I'm saying?
Just a reservoir of pain and combined with innocence there and like wanting to try hard, wanting to be like, hey, you stole my cigarettes or you stole my pornos or whatever and fighting with coons. But it's like, no, you're actually the guy who is going to fight back tears while telling Giamatti about your dad at that dinner. Like there's a long ass shot. No cuts of the camera just slowly pulling away as he is talking about his dad. And it's like, you got something.
And you're onto something there, Jed, with like the Baumbach movies, a very talky movie and a movie that's very dependent on like timing and things like that. You know, I was talking about some of those camera moves earlier, but a lot of pretty complicated camera moves in dialogue scenes, which you would think means like a lot of timing on how they're delivering dialogue. And keeping all that in mind does seem just technically more difficult just hearing about, you know, how difficult it is to act in front of a camera anyways, just seems like somebody without that experience, it is pretty impressive to be able to do it in a movie like this. Like, yeah, it feels different maybe if the camera's sitting in the corner shooting a scene.
Yeah, a lot of
right? Like that seems like you could, I don't know.
This might sound funny, but like some of his energy reminded me of some of the moments of Baumbach in, or of a Driver in the like While We're Young, you know, the one with Ben Stiller where he's like plays like a documentary filmmaker. And it's just like that young D-bag that's like trying to be cool. Like that like energy was dripping off of him in some of those moments. It just really stood out to me.
Should casting directors do this more often where it's like we should, our leads should be either very raw or have spent significant time on this location that we are filming? Because like I bet he was able to draw some energy from like the hallways that he was in school with and had conversations and made memories and went on emotional journeys with people on. Like was that energy stored in the walls and he was able to bring it back out in these familiar places?
I think there's a lot of examples of this like going well, but I'm sure there's a lot more examples of it going poorly, but we just don't hear about those movies because they're not revered or talked about, you know.
We don't talk about bad movies on this podcast, which is nice.
But you even think about like, I don't know, I mean, again, this is like a much different situation because it's, you know, it gets a large franchise. But like you think about like Peter Jackson plucking Elijah Wood for Frodo Baggins. And obviously he didn't go on to have like a crazy career or even like, and again, it's different because he was a child at the time and they needed a child. But like, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, right, being plucked for Harry Potter. Like people that you're like, young people that you're looking to put on the your movie on the back on of their performance. It is really interesting rather than doing it with somebody that's been a child actor, right? That is polished, taking a bit more of a punt and going with something more raw. I think in this particular instance, it really works, right? The performance is raw. Maybe the energy needed to be that same kind of raw, but I would love to like hear an interview with him and Giamatti and just like understand because you are putting two people like on the complete opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Of like how long they've been acting, like the type of acting they've been doing. Even putting Giamatti with somebody that was like a child actor, that's an up and coming name, would be a completely different experience. But doing it with somebody that's like never acted before, you gotta like think that like there's a lot of coaching happening. There was a lot of knowledge share. And like you hope that it sets someone up like Sessa, who's clearly shown that he's got this incredible ability, this incredible talent, you know, to move forward and like do a lot more incredible projects. And I think the one thing he's got going for him is I could totally see with his hair cut different, you know, maybe a little stubble grown out. He could play older, right? You're not like he could, I feel like he could do projects now. It's not like some of those types of like younger actors that take on these roles. Then it's like, well, we got to wait like, you know, 8 years for them to be ready to play anything else but a high schooler.
I don't want to move off of Sess and Giamatti yet, but I do think we need to give some love to Divine Joy Randolph. And I know, I think that we love the Paul and Angus, like that's the crux of the movie, but like the emotional like gut punches often come from Divine Joy Randolph and what she's doing. Like when she is weeping like for her son, like that is very, it's so human and it's so, so real. I mean, she's maybe gotten not the most buzz, but I think especially amongst the more independent like award circles, she's gotten a lot of praise and a lot of love. And I was looking at that and I was like, well, you know, she wasn't maybe the first performance that I thought of with a movie, but then I don't know if there was just a more human performance from the movie.
Were you guys familiar with her before this? Because
no.
I watched Only Murders in the Building, and she plays the detective. Yeah. She's absolutely excellent in that. And then also, she's in The Lost City. You know, which...
I didn't remember that.
I think Lost City saved movie theaters.
That's what... I've heard that, speaking of Daniel Radcliffe.
Full circle.
Yeah, but... But no, I agree with you entirely, Chip. Like, I think she's the one that is showing, like, the most real emotion. And it's, like, almost making – it's, like, the one that forces Giamatti and Sessa to, like, come to terms with their ability to, like, block those emotions.
Yeah, and she'll call people out on their stuff. Not in the way Giamatti does, where he does it from, like, a high moral tower, you know? she'll call people out because she's like, just be human with me, right? Like you're trying to be something you're not, or you're not trying to be something that you should be. And I think that she's, I mean, dude, when she holds Angus's hand, man, that's just.
Yeah. She's amazing in this movie, like so good in this movie. I actually think this movie like sizzles whenever she's on screen, especially through the middle portions. After that first time that Paul asks Mary for, you know, for a drink, like when she pulls out her bottle to fill up her cup, he kind of extends his when she offers. Every other time they got together with her, you know, to watch late night TV or whatever, I don't know, the movie just like felt so comfortable.
Yeah, I really did love the newlywed game part of it all, and like the second time they cut, you know, clearly they'd watched it together all night, and when Sess is in there and they're just cracking up. Thought it was really good. I thought like a lot of really tender moments too. Like it's like I guess equating it to a video game, she kind of gets her own little like side quest, you know, when she goes to her sister's in when they go to Boston, and just some really tender moments, really affecting, you know, her sister saying like, oh, if it's a boy, the middle name will be the name of her deceased son. I think a lot of that was really good. She was able to play really reserved and then kind of have her larger moments of emotion, right? Because she's holding back a lot in, you know, and like we talked about that very first dinner scene.
I mean, this is a cliche, but the movie doesn't work without her, you know?
Oh, sure not. I guess you can kind of parlay this. Do you think that if there was a performance Oscar to be nominated, do you think it's her, Best Supporting?
To be nominated or to win?
Nominated.
Yeah. I think so. I don't know.
Or do you think it's Sessa?
Man,
I kind of think Giamatti is going to get nominated.
But who do you want?
Or for supporting? Do you think they'll do a little bit of?
Oh, he would be Giamatti. Lead.
Oh,
yeah, but they could totally do some category fraud and say that Sessa is the.
It's pretty aggressive, right?
That'd be shocking.
I think he's running in Best Actor. I could see that just because. One, I think he's very good, but also I feel like the Academy kind of likes a guy like that, like somebody who has been in a ton of stuff, but isn't as often asked to be the lead. And especially people seem to really be liking this movie. I mean, this is a Paul Giamatti vehicle like that we're riding in right now. So I feel like if this movie does well nomination-wise, that he will get one.
And, yeah, I mean, the Academy loves the old white guy who learns his lesson from a diverse cast.
True.
In terms of the role.
It's basically exactly 20 years since Sideways, right? When a lot of people thought that he would get a nomination and didn't. Mm-hmm. He got a nomination for Cinderella Man in 2006 for Best Supporting. So it's like somebody that's like on the radar of the Academy, obviously kind of a much different Academy than in years past. But I mean, you got to imagine he's going to get a nom, right? At the very least.
Who else is getting nom? Killian. Killian probably wins.
Yeah, Killian doesn't win.
Leo probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because De Niro would be supporting and Leo would probably be lead.
Uh-huh.
Because Lily's winning. If she doesn't win, then everything, we shut it down and we start over from scratch. Lily doesn't win.
Unless it's Emma.
We'll see.
I haven't even seen the movie I was making.
Neither have I. Evan, have you seen it?
Have I seen what?
Poor Things.
Yes. I saw it last night.
Would you say you have rich things to say about it?
I do. I have a lot to say.
Oh, wait. Interesting.
I'll hold off.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting.
I don't know what other leading actors. Like, I'm going through and I'm trying to figure it out.
Oh, Bradley Cooper is going to get nominated, I'm
Maestro.
Sure.
Okay. Bradley Cooper, maybe. Well,
Driver for
Adam
Ferrari.
Driver.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get into the car, I drive it fast.
Is somebody
Chris
from
Pratt
for
voicing Mario? <'Cause> By the way, the Mario movie fucking rips, guys. I hate to break it to you. It rips.
I know Diana liked it. I didn't see it.
Dude, can we get the Jason Schwartzman in Asteroid City train rolling? Like, is that even possible?
I mean, it should. I mean, but Wes just
are there like 10 better performances this year? No.
Wes just doesn't have. So. He doesn't. Wes doesn't have time for Oscar politics.
It's not Wes though. It's Jason.
Yeah, but he's too busy being in The Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbird and Snakes.
Hey, that was fun. That was a fun time.
I'm not discrediting. I want to see that movie, but
he plays the Flickerman character that Tucci played in the original. Like his, it's I think it's literally like his grandpa is who.
Tucci, man. Tucci's the fucking. I love that he's just retired to making like Instagram, like home cook videos. But
I want to read his book.
Yeah. Anyway,
it's like a travel show too, I think.
Yeah, it's really good.
Stanley Tucci in Italy.
Searching for Italy. Yeah, it's got a couple seasons. He basically just eats his way through like multiple regions of Italy. So he like explores the different cuisines of the different regions of Italy. Highly entertaining. Don't watch it without like Italian food near. Honestly, every time I watched it, it was just like had to phone in some Italian. Shout out to Pietro's in Lodi, California. Very good Italian. Anyway, what do we think about the Oscar chances for this? Do you think Payne gets director? I think it's getting a lot of Best Picture buzz, right?
Yeah, I could see this coming away with a lot of nominations and no wins, unfortunately. Maybe not unfortunately. There's a lot of worthy contenders, I think, this
editing?
Year. Maybe. I don't know how many below the line categories it's going to get nominated.
I could see editing. For this, just because of all like the old school, like you talk about all the swipe cuts, all those things, it feels like something very intentional that they might, you know, recognize.
Yeah, the 70-year-old Oscar voters are going to get a boner for that. Their first boner in years. Just terrible joke. Turn my mic off. Someone
this
throw
year's,
my mic
this
off.
Year's Oscar ceremony is brought to you by Cialis.
Like it could, I don't know. Am I crazy for saying maybe it could get like a cinematography? No.
No,
I mean, for the same reasons, yeah, I could see it.
You're thinking the same thing. Screenplay, right?
Yeah, I could see it. We also should mention that Alexander Payne doesn't write lots of these movies, which is actually kind of interesting. But
dig that.
It is well written.
I do kind of dig that. Like the whole writer director thing is obviously we appreciate that, but I do love when a movie is like a collaborative effort. You know, obviously all films are, but I love when it's not just a singular vision sometimes. And like when you talk about like a director, like, you know, we just talked about Fincher, but like Fincher didn't write The Killer, you know, but seeing something that he could offer to that story and choosing that project, I think it's always fun.
Of course.
But it's definitely going to get nominated for Best Pick, right?
I think so.
I could see it. Yeah. Do you guys think this is one of the best movies of the year?
Yeah, I think it's up
personally.
There.
I do.
I do. I mean, we'll get into this towards the end, like our personal feelings and in our kind of review section.
Chip, I think we're towards the end, brother. Feel free to.
I have 17 more things to say about.
Yeah, Chip's like just like towards the end. We're like an hour and 10 minutes into this podcast.
I forgot what podcast we're doing. It's definitely one of my favorites of the year. It is so perfectly down. Like I keep coming back to this phrase down the middle of the road, because that's kind of what it is in a lot of ways. Now it's a high road to go back to some of y'all's points. It's a road maybe in the sky, but it's a story that stays in the lines, right? You gotta forgive my metaphors.
I'm sorry, but
here.
the road maybe in the sky is one of the greatest. It's a road maybe in the sky. I love it. I love that.
It's just a really nice story. It's such a cozy movie. You know, I really felt like I was tucked in.
You know, I talked about the Feast of Seven Fishes movie as a recommendation last week, right? Yeah. And it's just like a really like straightforward two and a half star, three star, but enjoyable. Like this is the prestige version of that, right? Like that's I get what you're saying, right? It's as well as middle of the road can be made, but it still is middle of the road in a way.
Yeah, that ends with the I won't almost pull exactly how it ends, but it ends with a penis cancer joke. And expensive liquor getting spat out onto the road.
You are penis cancer in human form. Evan, what about you? One of the best movies of the year for you?
It's up there. I don't know.
Top 10?
I don't know. It's kind of right around maybe that point right now. Like in the 10 to 15 range for me, probably. Closer to 10. I really like this movie a lot. I think we're going to start talking about it over the next few weeks. I think there have been like a lot of like great movies this year. Yeah, maybe I say a lot compared to some other years.
I mean, this has been the best post-pandemic movie year for sure.
I think so.
Yeah, not even close.
2021 was really solid. Like at least based on like the best picture contenders that year. Like the top 10 in the best picture race that year was pretty awesome top to bottom.
I think there's been some good movies kind of fallen by the wayside, but just like there's been some good movies this year that aren't, you know, generating a ton of buzz. I think
that's for sure.
Difference.
We got the third Paul Schrader Lonely Man movie and no one talks about it. And it was amazing.
Is that available? Can I see that?
Yes, I saw it like 6 months ago. Also, I'm not supposed to give my thoughts on that movie. That's a movie that I've declared that like no one's allowed to hear my opinion on it unless they pay me, because it's a complicated film with a complicated protagonist.
Okay.
Make some wild guesses.
To answer my own question, I do think it's one of the best 10 movies of the year. I do think it deserves an Oscar nomination. Kind of want to watch it again.
Yeah.
I could see myself watching this ages as a Christmas movie.
That's what I was going to say. I could see myself wanting to throw this on next, like, November 14th, you know?
I think it's a much better movie than this, but it kind of, like, to me, can occupy the same holiday movie headspace as, like, The Family Stone. You know? Where it's like, I want to watch something that's, like, there's a little bit sentimental, a little bit sad. I'm not just trying to feel good about my holidays.
Yes. It's not like a corny Christmas movie. It's a grown-up Christmas time movie. So again, watch it November, December, January. Watch it when it snows. Watch it when you're snowed in. When you're feeling a little lonely and you kind of want to feel okay about feeling lonely, I think, is a good way to put it. And then you open with this, Jeb, but like the found family thing, right? And this is like a time where heightened emotions are everywhere for people when it comes to being with family, not being with family, being with found family. I mean, this movie is so great because it's like, hey, these people, you can form this found family bond with them, and it doesn't even matter how like long or intense that bond is. Like Angus and Mary didn't have really those peak emotional moments. They were like Mary was kind of there on the outskirts for them, but like she was still the one holding his hand at the end of that movie, right?
You believe it too.
Yeah, you totally do.
Feels earned.
Yeah.
Let's give it a grade real quick before we get out of Dodge. I'm gonna go with exactly what I gave it on Letterboxd, 4.5 stars for me, which that's an A. It's a 90. So I really, really enjoyed this movie. And I don't know if I've said that enough, but I thought this movie was great. It was kind of exactly what I needed when I needed it. And I think that's part of why I liked it so much. I really like it. Alexander Payne, I think we should dedicate a whole episode to him. Maybe we should let it lie a little bit. And maybe if he starts getting some more Oscar noms, but I would love to do a ranking for him and like really dive into his filmography.
I'll give it the grade that Paul gave to Angus, B+. Seems appropriate.
Yeah. I have it as a B+ as well, and I am excited to see it again. Honestly, I think I like it more now than I did at the beginning of the podcast after listening to you guys.
I love when that happens.
And I think that, yeah, that also means that it's going to grow in my estimation the more I see it. Like, I'm excited to show this movie to people. Like, I definitely want to watch it with Emily because I didn't get to the first time. I think it's one that's easy to recommend and not be sitting on the couch like, oh boy. Yeah, look at their face and make sure they're not falling asleep.
Has your mom seen it yet?
She is not. Oh no, yes, she has, and she really liked it.
Yeah, I just like really,
really liked Giamatti.
I could really see her enjoying this.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I feel like this is a movie that you could show people and it's like palatable. And like, hey, mm-hmm. especially like we talked about like the holiday. I'm interested to watch it next holiday season and be like, oh, guys, like, this is a good Christmas movie that came out next year. Yeah. Or that came out next year. Ooh, Christopher Nolan.
Saw this movie in 2021. This
movie came out next year. All right, let's wrap it. Thanks as always for listening. If you haven't already, follow us on Twitter, Flick and Scream, on Instagram at Flicking and Screaming. Join us on flickingandscreaming.com for blogs and more tomfoolery. Any parting thoughts, gentlemen, before we get out of here?
I got a test. I got to study for Peloponnesian War. Got to study up. As soon as we're done here, hit the books, kids.
Chapter 6.
If you can, get to a movie theater. There are some good movies coming out over the next couple weeks.
You heard him. The bastion of theaters. It's Tom Cruise. It's Evan Fagundes. They save theaters. I'm just happy to be his co-host on this podcast. Jed Sprague, JT Chipman, and savior, the Jesus Christ of theaters, Evan Fagundes. Have a good one, everybody.
See ya.
And now, the starting lineup for your...
Gangsters, what's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
Envy.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.